What does it mean to belong anywhere when the country of your birth treats you as an outsider? Maya Angelou stood at this crossroads in 1957, having just returned from touring Europe with Porgy and Bess, pockets full of savings from nightclub gigs, and a restless hunger for something she couldn't yet name. She moved into a houseboat commune in Sausalito with her teenage son Guy, seeking refuge among white beatniks who seemed less concerned with skin color than with poetry and jazz. But temporary escape isn't the same as true freedom. As Guy grew wilder without structure, Maya packed their bags once more, trusting that life would catch her if she dared to leap. The moment Maya walked into that school office, she could feel the air solidify around her. Three teachers stood before her, their faces hardening into a single expression of judgment. Mr. Baker's voice was cold and certain. "We do not allow Negro boys to use foul language in front of our girls." But Guy hadn't cursed. He'd simply shared facts from his science textbook about human reproduction. How do you explain your black son to people who've already decided his guilt? How do you tell them that the contrived arrogance you've given him is armor, not attitude, because the world tells him daily he came from nothing and is going nowhere? Days later, the school sent a letter claiming Guy's wonderful grades earned him advancement to another school. The lie was so transparent it insulted them both. Maya immediately moved them to the diverse Westlake District, where Guy saw black children playing on the street for the first time in months. His giddiness revealed how much he'd been starving for connection with his own people. John Killens invited Maya to join the Harlem Writers Guild. At her first reading, her voice squeaked and hands trembled. John Henrik Clark's verdict stung. No life and very little love in the play. But the Guild's demanding standards were a gift. They took writing seriously enough to expect excellence. When Naya asked what literary form was hardest, Killen said short stories were so impossible they almost can't be written at all. She accepted the challenge immediately. To pay rent, Maya sang at a small Lower East Side club, then at the Apollo Theater, the pinnacle for black entertainers. Frank Schiffman warned her audience participation song, Uhuru, wouldn't work with Apollo crowds. But Maya sensed something Schiffman couldn't. Harlem was changing. African drums echoed closer than they had in a century. Opening night proved her right. When she sang Uhuru, the audience claimed it, singing freedom with such passion it became theirs. After that run, Maya knew she would never sing professionally again. She was leaving show business at its peak, walking towards something she couldn't yet name. At church, Maya heard Martin Luther King Jr. speak about the violent South and reclaiming the country's soul. Inspired, she and Godfrey Cambridge organized a fundraising show for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. At the SCLC office, white allies Stanley Levison and Jack Murray gently challenged her assumptions about who could understand oppression. Unable to write a worthy script, Maya broke down until Godfrey proposed a cabaret featuring entertainers doing their own acts. Cabaret for Freedom blazed with energy. Comedians made audiences howl until Langston Hughes's The Emperor of Haiti introduced gravity. Leontine Watts sang Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child a cappella, highlighting how oppression had orphaned black Americans. Despite the show's success, performers returned to menial jobs. Offered the SCLC coordinator position, Maya protested she couldn't type. John Killens dismissed her fears. "If you're going to live at all, your business is trying." Months later, Maya finally met King, surprisingly young, with easy friendliness that felt surreal. When she revealed her brother Bailey was in Sing Sing, King responded without judgment. "Never stop loving him. Never give up on him. And remember, he is freer than those who hold him behind bars." Jean Genet's The Blacks gave Maya a stage to ridicule every cruel white person who had ever injured her. The cast, including Godfrey Cambridge, James Earl Jones, Cicely Tyson, and Lou Gossett, performed with scorn, sneering at white saints and spitting on white gods. White audiences loved it, standing at curtain calls shouting, "Bravo!" As agreed, the cast refused to bow or smile. They were courageous black people staring directly into enemy eyes. A tearful white woman told Maya she'd seen it 5 times. When Maya asked how many Blacks lived in her building or how many Black friends she had, the woman backed away offended. White people consumed Black rage as entertainment, but refused to address it in reality. After 6 months coordinating for the SCLC, Maya returned each evening to Brooklyn, where the magic disappeared. She met Thomas Allen, a bail bondsman, kind, gentle, generous to guy. Their relationship thrived on passionate sex and Maya's cooking, but they never really talked. Then, Maya heard about Vusumzi Make, a South African freedom fighter volunteers praised as brilliant and calm. His presence electrified her. Sparks seemed to be shooting from him to my nipples and my ears. When they danced, he pulled her close. "I intend to change your life. I am going to take you to Africa." Maya couldn't marry Thomas, only to resent him for costing her adventure. "I'll do it. I'll go with you." Make's face broke open with joy. This is the joining of Africa and Africa-America. Their plane landed in Cairo, the Sahara stretching endlessly. Vus led them to a lavishly furnished apartment, but housekeeper Omanadia revealed crushing debts, furniture on installment, overdue rent, unpaid school fees. Desperate, Maya took a job as associate editor at the Arab Observer. When Vus discovered this, he erupted in fury. During his tirade, Maya realized with shocking clarity she no longer loved him. She immersed herself in the magazine's library, devouring everything about journalism and Africa. Her skills flourished, earning raises and recognition. At home, silence reigned. When confronted about infidelity, Vus claimed men need more sexual gratification and invoked his African right to polygamy. Maya reminded him they'd met in America, where monogamy was expected. He replied smugly, "I met you in the US, but now we are in Africa." Finally, she told him plainly, "I don't love you anymore." The next day, her friend Bonte called, inviting Maya over. She arrived to find a tribunal, 20 people in a crescent, Vus at center. This was palaver, formal dispute resolution. After deliberation, Joe Williamson announced Maya had won, Vus must provide refreshments, and she could leave. Then came the twist. "Now that the triumph is in your hands, we throw ourselves on your mercy. Would you please give the man one more chance?" Maya agreed to stay 6 months. After 5, she began planning her escape to West Africa. On the plane to Ghana, Maya wept as Africa stretched below, the land where her ancestors had been captured and enslaved. At Accra Airport, she and Guy were stunned to see Black pilots in uniform with epaulettes. In America, Black men in airports only fueled planes or worked as skycaps. She knew immediately Ghana was where Guy should attend college, free from racial discrimination. After Guy's serious car accident, Maya needed work and housing. Through Julian Mayfield, she met Afua Sutherland, poet and head of Ghana's theater, who secured her a position as administrative assistant at the University of Ghana and arranged a furnished campus house. "Sister, I am a mother too," Afua said simply. When the university rejected Guy for lacking British credentials, Maya lobbied persistently until they arranged a special entrance exam, which he passed brilliantly. Years earlier, when Maya met her mother at the Desert Hotel in Fresno, every white face blazed with fury at their presence. Her mother moved through the hostility like weather. In her room, she revealed a German Luger. "Animals can sense fear," she told Maya. "Human beings are animals too. Never let a person know you're frightened." Then she smiled. "The Desert Hotel better be ready for integration, because if it's not, I'm ready for the Desert Hotel." As Guy prepared for the dormitory, Maya cautioned him about his healing neck. He responded with quiet maturity. "Mom, I know I'm your only child and you love me, but there's something for you to remember. It is my neck and my life. I will live it whole or not at all." Embracing her, he added, "I love you, Mom. Maybe now you'll have a chance to grow up." When his Ghanaian friends arrived to help him move, she tried delaying their departure, but soon they were gone. She waited for waves of emotion, but felt neither bereft nor abandoned. Her first thought was perfectly formed. At last, I'll be able to eat the whole breast of a roast chicken by myself. After years of putting everyone else first, her son, her husband's, her causes, Maya had finally found freedom to live for herself. This decision launched a transformative decade. From nightclub singer to civil rights coordinator, from actress to journalist, and ultimately into the writer whose words would echo across generations. True liberation doesn't come from perfect circumstances or righteous causes alone. It arrives in quiet moments when you realize your life is finally completely your own.